own language. A tremendous cheer went up from the walkers, and Garrity felt weak tears beneath his eyelids. The crowd was silent. The spot behind Mike and Scram was barren and empty. They took second warning, then sat down together, cross-legged, and began to talk together calmly. And that was pretty goddamn strange, Garrity thought as they passed by, because Scram and Mike did not seem to be talking in the same language. He did not look back. None of them looked back. Not even after it was over. "Whoever wins better keep his word," McVree said suddenly. "He just better." No one said anything. Chapter 13 2 in the afternoon.
"You're cheating, you fuck," Abraham shouted.
"I'm not cheating," Baker said calmly. "That's $1.40 you owe me, Turkey."
"I don't pay cheaters."
Abraham clutched the dime he had been flipping tightly in his hand.
"And I usually don't match dimes with guys that call me that," Baker said grimly, and then smiled. "But in your case, Abe, I'll make an exception. You have so many winning ways, I just can't help myself."
"Shut up and flip," Abraham said.
"Oh, please, don't take that tone of voice to me," Baker said abjectly, rolling his eyes. "I might fall over in a dead faint."
Garrity laughed. Abraham snorted and flicked his dime, caught it, and slapped it down on his wrist.
"You match me."
"Okay."
Baker flipped his dime higher, caught it more deftly, and, Garrity was sure, palmed it on edge.
"You show first this time," Baker said.
"Nuh-uh, I showed first last time."
"Oh shit, Abe, I showed first 3 times in a row before that. Maybe you're the one cheating."
Abraham muttered, considered, and then revealed his dime. It was tails, showing the Potomac River framed in laurel leaves. Baker raised his hand, peeked under it, and smiled. His dime also showed tails.
"That's $1.50 you owe me."
"My God, you must think I'm dumb," Abraham hollered. "You think I'm some kind of idiot, right? Go on and admit it. Just taking the rube to the cleaners, right?"
Baker appeared to consider.
"Go on, go on," Abraham bellowed. "I can take it."
"Now that you put it to me," Baker said, "whether or not you're a rube never entered my mind. That you're an idiot is pretty well established. As far as taking you to the cleaners," he put a hand on Abraham's shoulder, "that, my friend, is a certainty."
"Come on," Abraham said craftily. "Double or nothing for the whole bundle. And this time, you show first."
Baker considered. He looked at Garrity.
"Ray, would you?"
"Would I what?" Garrity had lost track of the conversation. His left leg had begun to feel decidedly strange.
"Would you go double or nothing against this here fella?"
"Why not? After all, he's too dumb to cheat you."
"Garrity, I thought you were my friend," Abraham said coldly.
"Okay, $1.50, double or nothing," Baker said.
And that was when the monstrous pain bolted up Garrity's left leg, making all the pain of the last 30 hours seem like a mere whisper in comparison.
"My leg, my leg, my leg," he screamed, unable to help himself.
"Oh, Jesus, Garrity," Baker had time to say.
Nothing in his voice but mild surprise. And then they had passed beyond him. It seemed that they were all passing him as he stood here with his left leg turned to clenched and agonizing marble, passing him, leaving him behind.
"Warning! Warning, 47!
"Don't panic. If you panic now, you've had the course." He sat down on the pavement. His left leg stuck out woodenly in front of him. He began to massage the big muscles. He tried to knead them. It was like trying to knead ivory.
"Garrity?"
It was McVries. He sounded scared. Surely that was only an illusion.
What is it, Charlie Horse?
Yeah, I guess so. Keep going, it'll be all right.
Time. Time was speeding up for him, but everyone else seemed to have slowed to a crawl, to the speed of an instant replay on a close play at first base. McVries was picking up his pace slowly, one heel showing, then the other. A glint from the worn nails, a glimpse of cracked and tissue-thin shoe leather. Barkovich was passing by slowly, a little grin on his face. A wave of tense quiet came over the crowd slowly, moving outward in both directions from where he had sat down, like great glassy combers headed for the beach.
My second warning, Garrity thought. My second warning's coming up. Come on, Leg. Come on, goddamn Leg. I don't want to buy a ticket. What do you say? Come on, give me a break.
Warning. Second warning, 47.
Yeah, I know. You think I can't keep score? You think I'm sitting here trying to get a suntan?
The knowledge of death, as true and unarguable as a photograph, was trying to get in and swamp him, trying to paralyze him. He shut it out with a desperate coldness. His thigh was excruciating agony, but in his concentration, he barely felt it.
A minute left. No, 50 seconds now. No, 45. It's dribbling away. My time's going.
With an abstract, almost professorly expression on his face, Garrity dug his fingers into the frozen straps and harnesses of muscle. He kneaded. He flexed. He talked to his leg in his head.
Come on, come on, come on, goddamn thing.
His fingers began to ache, and he did not notice that much either. Stebbins passed him and murmured something. Garrity did not catch what it was. It might have been good luck. Then he was alone, sitting on the broken white line between the travel lane and the passing lane. All gone. The carny just left town, pulled stakes in the middle of everything in Blue Town. No one left but this here kid Garrity to face the emptiness of flattened candy wrappers and squashed cigarette butts and discarded junk prizes. All gone except one soldier, young and blonde and handsome in a remote sort of way. His silver chronometer was in one hand, his rifle in the other. No mercy in that face.
Warning! Warning 47! Third warning 47!
The muscle was not loosening at all.
He was going to die.
After all this, after ripping his guts out, that was the fact after all. He let go of his leg and stared calmly at the soldier. He wondered who was going to win. He wondered if McVries would outlast Barkovich. He wondered what a bullet in the head felt like, if it would just be sudden darkness, or if he would actually feel his thoughts being ripped apart. The last few seconds began to drain away. The cramp loosened. Blood flowed back into the muscle, making it tingle with needles and pins, making it warm. The blonde soldier with the remotely handsome face put away the pocket chronometer. His lips moved soundlessly as he counted down the last few seconds.
But I can't get up, Garrity thought. It's too good just to sit. Just sit and let the phone ring. The hell with it. Why didn't I take the phone off the hook?
Garrity let his head fall back. The soldier seemed to be looking down at him as if from the mouth of a tunnel or over the lip of a deep well. In slow motion, he transferred the gun to both hands, and his right forefinger kissed over the trigger, then curled around it, and the barrel started to come around. The soldier's left hand was solid on the stock. A wedding band caught a glimmer of sun. Everything was slow. So slow.
Just hold the phone.
This, Garrity thought. This is what it's like. To die. The soldier's right thumb was rotating the safety catch to the off position with exquisite slowness. Three scrawny women were directly behind him,
three weird sisters. Hold the phone. Just hold the phone a minute longer. I've got something to die here. Sunshine, shadow, blue sky. Clouds rushing up the highway. Stebbins was just a back now. Just a blue work shirt with a sweat stain running up between the shoulder blades. Goodbye, Stebbins. Sounds thundered in on him. He had no idea if it was his imagination or heightened sensibility or simply the fact of death reaching out for him. The safety catch snapped off with a sound like a breaking branch. The rush of indrawn air between his teeth was the sound of a wind tunnel. His heartbeat was a drum, and there was a high singing, not in his ears, but between them, spiraling up and up, and he was crazily sure that it was the actual sound of brain waves. He scrambled to his feet in a convulsive flying jerk, screaming. He threw himself into an accelerating, gliding run. His feet were made of feathers. The finger of the soldier tightened on the trigger and whitened. He glanced down at the solid-state computer on his waist, a gadget that included a tiny but sophisticated sonar device. Garrity had once read an article about them in Popular Mechanics. They could read out a single walker's speed as exactly as you would have wanted, to four numbers to the right of the decimal point. The soldier's finger loosened. Garrity slowed to a very fast walk, his mouth cottony dry, his heart pounding at a trip hammer speed. Irregular white flashes pulsed in front of his eyes, and for a sick moment he was sure he was going to faint. It passed. His feet, seemingly furious at being denied their rightful rest, screamed at him rawly. He gritted his teeth and bore the pain. The big muscle in his left leg was still twitching alarmingly, but he wasn't limping. So far. He looked at his watch. It was 2:17 p.m. For the next hour, he would be less than 2 seconds from death. "Back to the land of the living," Stebbins said as he caught up. "Sure," Garrity said numbly. He felt a sudden wave of resentment. They would have gone on walking even if he had bought his ticket. No tears shed for him. Just a name and number to be entered in the official records. Garrity Raymond, number 47. Eliminated 218th mile. And a human interest story in the state newspapers for a couple of days. Garrity dead. Maine's own becomes 61st to fall. "I hope I win," Garrity muttered. "Think you will?" Garrity thought of the blonde soldier's face. It had shown as much emotion as a plate of potatoes. "I doubt it," he said. "I've already got 3 strikes against me. That means you're out, doesn't it?" "Call the last one a foul tip," Stebbins said. He was regarding his feet again. Garrity picked his own feet up, his 2-second margin like a stone in his head. There would be no warning this time. Not even time for someone to say, "You better pick it up, Garrity. You're going to draw one." He caught up with McVries, who glanced around. "I thought you were out of it, kiddo," McVries said.
"So did I."
"That close?"
"About 2 seconds, I think."
McVries pursed a silent whistle. "I don't think I'd like to be in your shoes right now. How's the leg?"
"Better. Listen, I can't talk. I'm going up front for a while."
"It didn't help Harkness any."
Garrity shook his head. "I have to make sure I'm topping the speed."
"All right. You want company?"
"If you've got the energy."
McVries laughed. "I got the time if you got the money, honey."
"Come on, then. Let's pick it up while I've still got the sack for it."
Garrity stepped up his pace until his legs were at the point of rebellion, and he and McVries moved quickly through the front runners. There was a space between the boy who had been walking second a gangling, evil-faced boy named Harold Kintz, and the survivor of the two leather boys, Joe. Closer to, his complexion was startlingly bronzed. His eyes stared steadily at the horizon, and his features were expressionless. The many zippers on his jacket jingled, like the sound of faraway music. "Hello, Joe," McVree said, and Garrity had an hysterical urge to add, "What do you know?"
"Howdy," Joe said curtly.
They passed him, and then the road was theirs. A wide, double-barreled strip of composition concrete, stained with oil and broken by the grassy median strip, bordered on both sides by a steady wall of people.
"Onward, ever onward," McVree said. "Christian soldiers marching as to war. Ever hear that one, Ray?"
"What time is it?"
McVree's glanced at his watch. 2:20. "Look, Ray, if you're going to—"
"God, is that all? I thought—"
He felt panic rising in his throat, greasy and thick.
He wasn't going to be able to do it. The margin was just too tight.
"Look, if you keep thinking about the time, you're going to go nuts and try to run into the crowd, and they'll shoot you dog dead. They'll shoot you with your tongue hanging out and spit running down your chin. Try to forget about it."
"I can't."
Everything was bottling up inside him, making him feel jerky and hot and sick.
"Olson. Scram. They died. Davidson died. I can die too, Pete. I believe it now. It's breathing down my fucking back."
"Think about your girl, Jan What's-Her-Face, or your mother, or your goddamn kitty cat, or don't think about anything. Just pick 'em up and put 'em down. Just keep on walking down the road. Concentrate on that."
Garrity fought for control of himself. Maybe he even got a little. But he was unraveling just the same. His legs didn't want to respond smoothly to his mind's commands anymore. They seemed as old and as flickery as ancient light bulbs.
"He won't last much longer," a woman in the front row said quite audibly.
"Your tits won't last much longer,"
Garrity snapped at her, and the crowd cheered him.
"They're screwed up," Garrity muttered. "They're really screwed up. Perverted. What time is it, McVree's?"
"What was the first thing you did when you got your letter of confirmation?" McVree's asked softly. "What did you do when you knew you were really in?"
Garrity frowned, wiped his forearm quickly across his forehead, and then let his mind free of the sweaty, terrifying present to that sudden, flashing moment.
"I was by myself. My mother works. It was a Friday afternoon. The letter was in the mailbox, and it had a Wilmington, Delaware postmark, so I knew that had to be it. But I was sure it said I'd flunked the physical or the mental or both. I had to read it twice. I didn't go into any fits of joy, but I was pleased. Real pleased. And confident. My feet didn't hurt then, and my back didn't feel like somebody had shoved a rake with a busted handle into it. I was one in a million. I wasn't bright enough to realize the circus fat lady is, too."
He broke off for a moment, thinking, smelling early April.
"I couldn't back down. There were too many people watching. I think it must work the same with just about everyone. It's one of the ways they tip the game, you know? I let the April 15th back-out date go by, and the day after that, they had a big testimonial dinner for me at the town hall. All my friends were there, and after dessert, everyone started yelling, 'Speech, speech.' And I got out and mumbled something down at my hands about how I was going to do the best I could if I got in. And everyone applauded like mad. It was like I'd laid the fucking Gettysburg Address on their heads. You know what I mean?"
"Yes, I know," McVree said, and laughed, but his eyes were dark.
Behind them, the guns thunderclapped suddenly. Garrity jumped convulsively and nearly froze in his tracks. Somehow he kept walking. Blind instinct this time, he thought. What about next time?
Son of a bitch, McVree said softly. It was Joe.
What time is it?
Garrity asked, and before McVree's could answer, he remembered that he was wearing a watch of his own. It was 2:38.
Christ.
His 2-second margin was like an iron dumbbell on his back. No one tried to talk you out of it? McVree's asked. They were far out beyond the rest now, better than 100 yards beyond Harold Kint's. A soldier had been dispatched to keep tabs on them. Garrity was very glad it wasn't the blonde guy. No one tried to talk you into using the April 31st blackout?
Not at first. My mother and Jan and Dr. Patterson, he's my mother's special friend, you know, they've been keeping company for the last 5 years or so. They just kind of soft-pedaled it at first. They were pleased and proud because most of the kids in the country over 12 take the tests, but only 1 in 50 passes. And that still leaves thousands of kids, and they can use 200, 100 walkers and 100 backups. And there's no skill in getting picked, you know that.
Sure, they draw the names out of that cock-sucking drum.
Big TV spectacular.
McVree's voice cracked a little.
Yeah, the major draws the 200 names, but the names are all they announce. You don't know if you're a walker or just a backup.
And no notification of which you are until the final backout date itself, McVree's agreed, speaking of it as if the final backout date had been years ago instead of only 4 days. Yeah, they like to stack the deck their way. Somebody in the crowd had just released a flotilla of balloons. They floated up to the sky in a dissolving arc of reds, blues, greens, yellows. The steady south wind carried them away with taunting, easy speed.
I guess so, Garrity said. We were watching the TV when the major drew the names. I was number 73 out of the drum. I fell right out of my chair. I just couldn't believe it.
No, it can't be you, McVree's agreed. Things like that always happen to the other guy.
Yeah, that's a feeling. That's when everybody started in on me. It wasn't like the first backout date, when it was all speeches and pie in the sky by and by.
Jan... He broke off.
Why not? He'd told everything else. It didn't matter.
Either he or McVree's was going to be dead before it was over. Probably both of them.
Jan said she'd go all the way with me, anytime, any way, as often as I wanted if I'd take the April 31st backout. I told her that would make me feel like an opportunist and a heel, and she got mad at me and said it was better than feeling dead, and then she cried a lot and begged me.
Garrity looked up at McVree's.
I don't know. Anything else she could have asked me, I would have tried to do it. But this one thing, I couldn't. It was like there was a stone caught in my throat. After a while, she knew I couldn't say, yes, okay, I'll call the 800 number. I think she started to understand. Maybe as well as I did myself, which God knows isn't very well.
Then Dr. Patterson started in. He's a diagnostician, and he's got a wicked logical mind. He said, look here, Ray, figuring in the prime group and the backups, your chance of survival is 50-1. Don't do this to your mother, Ray. I was polite with him for as long as I could, but finally I told him to just kiss off. I said I figured the odds on him ever marrying my mother were pretty long, but I never noticed him backing off because of that.
Garrity ran both hands through the straw thatch of his hair. He had forgotten about the 2-second margin. God, didn't he get mad? He ranted and raved and told me if I wanted to break my mother's heart to just go ahead. He said I was as insensitive as a wood tick.
I think that's what he said. Insensitive as a wood tick. Maybe it's a family saying of his or something, I don't know. He asked me how it felt to be doing the number on my mom and on a nice girl like Janice. So I countered with my own unarguable logic.
Did you? McVree said, smiling.
What was that?
I told him if he didn't get out, I was going to hit him.
What about your mother?
She didn't say much at all.
I don't think she could believe it. And the thought of what I'd get if I won, the prize, everything you want for the rest of your life, that sort of blinded her, I think.
I had a brother, Jeff. He died of pneumonia when he was 6, and it's cruel, but I don't know how we'd have gotten along if he'd have lived. And I guess she just kept thinking I'd be able to back out of it if I did turn out to be prime.
The major is a nice man, that's what she said. I'm sure he'd let you out of it if he understood the circumstances. But they squat them just as fast for trying to back out of a long walk as they do for talking against it. And then I got the call, and I knew I was a walker. I was prime.
I wasn't.
No?
No. 12 of the original walkers used the April 31st backout. I was number 12 backup. I got the call just past 11 p.m. 4 days ago.
Jesus, is that so?
Uh-huh. That close.
Doesn't it make you bitter?
McVries only shrugged. Garrity looked at his watch. It was 3:02. It was going to be all right. His shadow, lengthening in the afternoon sun, seemed to move a little more confidently. It was a pleasant, brisk spring day. His leg felt okay now.
Do you still think you might just sit down? He asked McVries. You've outlasted most of them. 61 of them.
How many you or I have outlasted doesn't matter, I think. There comes a time when the will just runs out. Doesn't matter what I think, see? I used to have a good time smearing away with oil paints. I wasn't too bad either. Then one day, bingo. I didn't taper off, I just stopped. Bingo. There was no urge to go on even another minute. I went to bed one night liking to paint, and when I woke up, it was nowhere.
Staying alive hardly qualifies as a hobby.
I don't know about that. How about skin divers, big game hunters, mountain climbers, or even some half-witted mill worker whose idea of a good time is picking fights on a Saturday night? All of those things reduce staying alive to a hobby. Part of the game.
Garrity said nothing.
Better pick it up some, McVries said gently. We're losing speed. Can't have that.
Garrity picked it up.
My dad has a half ownership in a drive-in movie theater, McVries said. He was going to tie me and gag me down in the cellar under the snack concession to keep me from coming, squads or no squads.
What did you do? Just wear him down?
There was no time for that. When the call came, I had just 10 hours. They laid on an airplane and a rental car at the Presque Isle Airport. He ranted and raved, and I just sat there and nodded and agreed, and pretty soon there was a knock on the door, and when my mom opened it, 2 of the biggest, meanest-looking soldiers you ever saw were standing on the porch. Man, they were so ugly they could have stopped clocks. My dad took one look at them and said, "Petey, you better go upstairs and get your Boy Scout pack."
McVries jolted the pack up and down on his shoulders and laughed at the memory.
And just about the next thing any of us knew, we were on that plane, even my little sister Katrina. She's only 4. We landed at 3 a.m. and drove up to the marker. And I think Katrina was the only who really understood. She kept saying, "Petey's going on an adventure."
McVries flapped his hands in an oddly uncompleted way. They're staying at a motel in Presque Isle. They didn't want to go home until it was over, one way or the other.
Garrity looked at his watch. It was 3:20.
Thanks, he said.
For saving your life again? McVries laughed merrily.
Yes, that's just right.
Are you sure that would be any kind of a favor?
I don't know.
Garrity paused.
I'll tell you something, though. It's never going to be the same for me, the time limit thing. Even when you're walking with no warnings, there's only 2 minutes between you and the inside of a cemetery fence. That's not much time.
As if on cue, the guns roared. The hold walker made a high gobbling sound, like a turkey grabbed suddenly by a silent stepping farmer. The crowd made a low sound that might have been a sigh or a groan or an almost sexual outletting of pleasure.
No time at all, McVries agreed.
They walked. The shadows got longer. Jackets appeared in the crowd as if a magician had conjured them out of a silk hat. Once Garrity caught a warm whiff of pipe smoke that brought back a hidden, bittersweet memory of his father. A pet dog escaped from someone's grasp and ran out into the road, red plastic leash dragging, tongue lolling out pinkly, foam flecked on its jaws. It yipped, chased drunkenly after its stubby tail, and was shot when it charged drunkenly at Pearson, who swore bitterly at the soldier who had shot it. The force of the heavy-caliber bullet drove it to the edge of the crowd, where it lay dull-eyed, panting, and shivering. No one seemed anxious to claim it. A small boy got past the police, wandered out into the left lane of the road, and stood there, weeping. A soldier advanced on him. A mother screamed shrilly from the crowd. For one horrified moment, Garrity thought the soldier was going to shoot the kid as the dog had been shot, but the soldier merely swept the little boy indifferently back into the crowd. At 6 p.m., the sun touched the horizon and turned the western sky orange. The air turned cold. Collars were turned up. Spectators stamped their feet and rubbed their hands together. Collie Parker registered his usual complaint about the goddamn Maine weather. By 9:15, we'll be in Augusta, Garrity thought. Just a hop, skip, and a jump from there to Freeport. Depression dropped over him.
What then?
2 minutes you'll have to see her, unless you should miss her in the crowd. God forbid.
Then what?
Fold up? He was suddenly sure Jen and his mother wouldn't be there anyway. Just the kids he had gone to school with, anxious to see the suicidal freak they had unknowingly nurtured among them. And the ladies' aide. They would be there. The ladies' aide had given him a tea 2 nights before the walk started, in that antique time.
Let's start dropping back, McVries said. We'll do it slow. Get together with Baker. We'll walk into Augusta together. The original Three Musketeers. What do you say, Garrity?
All right, Garrity said. It sounded good. They dropped back a little at a time, eventually leaving the sinister-faced Harold Kintz to lead the parade. They knew they were back with their own people when Abraham, out of the gathering gloom, asked,
"You finally decide to come back and visit the Poe folks?"
"Jesus, he really does look like him," McVries said, staring at Abraham's weary, 3-day bearded face, "especially in this light."
47 years ago, Abraham intoned,
and for an eerie moment it was as if a spirit had inhabited 17-year-old Abraham.
"Our fathers set forth on this continent—" "Ah, bullshit, I forget the rest. We had to learn it in 8th grade history if we wanted an A."
"The face of a founding father and the mentality of a syphilitic donkey," McVree said sadly. Abraham, how did you get into a balls up like this?
Bragged my way in, Abraham said promptly.
He started to go on, and the guns interrupted him. There was the familiar mail sack thud.
That was gallant, Baker said, looking back. He's been walking dead all day.
Bragged his way into it, Garrity mused, and then laughed.
Sure.
Abraham ran a hand up one cheek and scratched the cavernous hollow under one eye.
You know the essay test?
They all nodded. An essay, Why Do You Feel Qualified to Participate in a Long Walk, was a standard part of the mentals section of the exam. Garrity felt a warm trickle on his right heel and wondered if it was blood, pus, sweat, or all of the above. There seemed to be no pain, although his sock felt ragged back there.
Well, the thing was, Abraham said, I didn't feel particularly qualified to participate in anything. I took the exam completely on the spur of the moment. I was on my way to the movies, and I just happened to pass the gym where they were having the test. You have to show your work permit card to get in, you know. I just happened to have mine with me that day. If I hadn't, I wouldn't have bothered to go home and get it. I just would have gone on to the movies, and I wouldn't be here right now, dying in such jolly company.
They considered this silently.
I took the physical, and then I zipped through the objective stuff, and then I see this 3-page blank at the end of the folder. Please answer this question as objectively and honestly as you can, using not more than 1,500 words. Oh, holy shit, I think. The rest of it was sort of fun. What a bunch of fucked up questions.
Yeah, how often do you have a bowel movement?
Baker said dryly.
Have you ever used snuff?
Yeah, stuff like that, Abraham agreed. I'd forgotten all about that stupid snuff question. I just zipped along, bullshitting in good order, you know, and I come to this essay about why I feel qualified to participate. I couldn't think of a thing. So finally some bastard in an army coat strolls by and says, 5 minutes, will everyone finish up, please? So I just put down, I feel qualified to participate in the long walk because I am one useless SOB, and the world would be better off without me, unless I happen to win and get rich, in which case I would buy a Van Gogh to put in every room of my mansion and order up 60 high-class whores and not bother anybody. I thought about that for about a minute, and then I put in parentheses, I would give all my 60 high-class whores old-age pensions, too. I thought that would really screw them up. So a month later, I'd forgotten all about the whole thing. I get a letter saying I'm qualified. I damn near creamed my jeans.
And you went through with it? Collie Parker demanded.
Yeah, it's hard to explain. The thing was, everybody thought it was a big joke. My girlfriend wanted to have the letter photographed and get it turned into a t-shirt down at the shirt shack, like she thought I'd pulled the biggest practical joke of the century. It was like that with everybody. I'd get the big glad hand and somebody was always saying something like, Hey, Abe, you really tweaked the major's balls, didn't you? It was so funny I just kept on going. I tell you, Abraham said, smiling morbidly, it got to be a real laugh riot. Everybody thought I was just gonna go on tweaking the major's balls to the very end, which was what I did. Then one morning I woke up, and I was in. I was a prime walker, 16th out of the drum, as a matter of fact. So I guess it turned out the major was tweaking my balls.
An abortive little cheer went through the walkers, and Garrity glanced up. A huge reflector sign overhead informed them, Augusta, 10.
You could just die laughing, right? Collie said.
Abraham looked at Parker for a long time.
The Founding Father is not amused, he said hollowly.
Chapter 14. They had all pretty much agreed that there was little emotional stretch or recoil left in them. But apparently, Garrity thought tiredly as they walked into the roaring darkness along US 202 with Augusta a mile behind them, it was not so. Like a badly treated guitar that has been knocked about by an unfeeling musician, the strings were not broken, but only out of tune, discordant, chaotic. Augusta hadn't been like Old Town. Old Town had been a phony hick New York. Augusta was some new city, a once-a-year city of crazy revelers, a party-down city full of a million boogieing drunks and cuckoo birds and out-and-out maniacs. They had heard Augusta and seen Augusta long before they had reached Augusta. The image of waves beating on a distant shore recurred to Garrity again and again. They heard the crowd 5 miles out. The lights filled the sky with a bubble-like pastel glow that was frightening and apocalyptic, reminding Garrity of pictures he had seen in the history books of the German air blitz of the American East Coast during the last days of World War II. They stared at each other uneasily and bunched closer together like small boys in a lightning storm or cows in a blizzard. There was a raw redness in that swelling sound of crowd, a hunger that was numbing. Garrity had a vivid and scary image of the great god crowd clawing its way out of the Augusta Basin on scarlet spider legs and devouring them all alive. The town itself had been swallowed, strangled, and buried. In a very real sense, there was no Augusta, and there were no more fat ladies or pretty girls or pompous men or wet-crotched children waving puffy clouds of cotton candy. There was no bustling Italian man here to throw slices of watermelon. Only crowd, a creature with no body, no head, no mind. Crowd was nothing but a voice and an eye, and it was not surprising that crowd was both God and mammon. Garrity felt it. He knew the others were feeling it. It was like walking between giant electrical pylons, feeling the tingles and shock stand every hair on end, making the tongue jitter nuttily in the mouth, making the eyes seem to crackle and shoot off sparks as they rolled in their beds of moisture. Crowd was to be pleased. Crowd was to be worshipped and feared. Ultimately, crowd was to be made sacrifice unto. They plowed through ankle-deep drifts of confetti. They lost each other and found each other in a sheeting blizzard of magazine streamers. Garrity snatched a paper out of the dark and crazy air at random and found himself looking at a Charles Atlas bodybuilding ad. He grabbed another one and was brought face to face with John Travolta. And at the height of the excitement, at the top of the first hill on 202, overlooking the mobbed turnpike behind and the gorged and glutted town at their feet, two huge purple-white spotlights split the air ahead of them, and the major was there, drawing away from them in his jeep like an hallucination, holding his salute ramrod stiff, incredibly, fantastically oblivious of the crowd in the gigantic throes of its labor all around him. And the walkers, the strings were not broken on their emotions, only badly out of tune. They had cheered wildly with hoarse and totally unheard voices, the 37 of them that were left. The crowd could not know they were cheering, but somehow they did. Somehow they understood that the circle between death worship and death wish had been completed for another year, and the crowd went completely loopy, convulsing itself in greater and greater paroxysms. Garrity felt a stabbing, needling pain in the left side of his chest and was still unable to stop cheering, even though he understood he was driving at the very brink of disaster. A shifty-eyed walker named Milligan saved them all by falling to his knees, his eyes squeezed shut and his hands pressed to his temples as if he were trying to hold his brains in. He slid forward on the end of his nose abrading the tip of it on the road like soft chalk on a rough blackboard.
How amazing, Garrity thought. That kid's wearing his nose away on the road.
And then Milligan was mercifully blasted. After that, the walkers stopped cheering. Garrity was badly scared by the pain in his chest that was subsiding only partially. He promised that was the end of the craziness.
"We getting close to your girl?" Parker asked.
He had not weakened, but he had mellowed. Garrity liked him okay now.
"About 50 miles, maybe 60, give or take."
"You're one lucky son of a bitch, Garrity," Parker said wistfully.
"I am?"
He was surprised. He turned to see if Parker was laughing at him. Parker wasn't.
"You're going to see your girl and your mother. Who the hell am I going to see between now and the end?
No one but these pigs."
He gestured with his middle finger at the crowd, which seemed to take the gesture as a salute and cheered him deliriously.
"I'm homesick," he said, "and scared."
Suddenly he screamed at the crowd,
"Pigs! You pigs!"
They cheered him more loudly than ever.
"I'm scared too, and homesick. I mean, we...
He groped.
"We're all too far away from home. The road keeps us away. I may see them, but I won't be able to touch them."
"The rules say..."
"I know what the rules say, bodily contact with anyone I wish, as long as I don't leave the road. But it's not the same. There's a wall."
"Fucking easy for you to talk. You're going to see them just the same."
"Maybe that'll only make it worse," McVries said.
He had come quietly up behind them. They had just passed under a blinking yellow warning flasher at the Winthrop intersection. Garrity could see it waxing and waning on the pavement after they had passed it, a fearful yellow eye opening and closing.
"You're all crazy," Parker said amiably. "I'm getting out of here."
He put on a little speed and had soon nearly disappeared into the blinking shadows.
"He thinks we're queer for each other," McVries said amused.
"He what?"
Garrity's head snapped up.
"He's not such a bad guy," McVries said thoughtfully.
He cocked a humorous eye at Garrity.
"Maybe he's even half right.
Maybe that's why I saved your ass. Maybe I'm queer for you."
"With a face like mine, I thought you perverts liked the willowy type."
Still, he was suddenly uneasy. Suddenly, shockingly, McVries said,
"Would you let me jerk you off?"
Garrity hissed in breath.
"What the hell?"
"Oh, shut up," McVries said crossly. "Where do you get off with all this self-righteous shit? I'm not even going to make it any easier by letting you know if I'm joking. What say?"
Garrity felt a sticky dryness in his throat. The thing was, he wanted to be touched. Queer, not queer, that didn't seem to matter now that they were all busy dying. All that mattered was McVries. He didn't want McVries to touch him, not that way.
"Well, I suppose you did save my life."
Garrity let it hang.
McVries laughed. "I'm supposed to feel like a heel because you owe me something, and I'm taking advantage? Is that it?"
"Do what you want," Garrity said shortly. "But quit playing games."
"Does that mean yes?"
"Whatever you want," Garrity yelled.
Pearson, who had been staring, nearly hypnotized, at his feet, looked up, startled.
"Whatever you goddamn want," Garrity yelled.
McVries laughed again.
"You're all right, Ray. Never doubt it."
He clapped Garrity's shoulder and dropped back. Garrity stared after him, mystified.
"He just can't get enough," Pearson said tiredly.
"Huh?"
"Almost 250 miles, Pearson groaned. "My feet are like lead with poison inside them. My back's burning. And that screwed-up McVries doesn't have enough yet. He's like a starving man gobbling up laxatives.
He wants to be hurt, do you think?
Jesus, what do you think? He ought to be wearing a beat-me-hard sign. I wonder what he's trying to make up for.
I don't know, Garrity said. He was going to add something else, but he saw Pearson wasn't listening anymore. He was watching his feet again, his weary features drawn in lines of horror. He had lost his shoes. The dirty white athletic socks on his feet made gray-white arcs in the darkness. They passed a sign that said, Lewiston, 32, and a mile beyond that, an arched electric sign that proclaimed, Garrity, 47, in light bulb lettering. Garrity wanted to doze but was unable. He knew what Pearson meant about his back. His own spine felt like a blue rod of fire. The muscles at the backs of his legs were open, flaming sores. The numbness in his feet was being replaced by an agony much more sharp and defined than any that had gone before. He was no longer hungry, but he ate a few concentrates anyway. Several walkers were nothing but flesh-covered skeletons, concentration camp horrors. Garrity didn't want to get like that, but of course he was anyway. He ran a hand up his side and played the xylophone on his ribs. I haven't heard from Barkovich lately, he said in an effort to raise Pearson from his dreadful concentration. It was altogether too much like Olson reincarnated.
No, somebody said one of his legs went stiff on him coming through Augusta.
That right?
That's what they said.
Garrity felt a sudden urge to drop back and look at Barkovich. He was hard to find in the dark, and Garrity drew a warning, but finally he spotted Barkovich, now back in the rear echelon. Barkovich was scurrying gimply along, his face set in strained lines of concentration. His eyes were slitted down to a point where they looked like dimes seen edge-on. His jacket was gone. He was talking to himself in a low, strained monotone. "Hello, Barkovich," Garrity said. Barkovich twitched, stumbled, and was warned his third warning.
"There!" Barkovich screamed shrewishly. "There! See what you did? Are you and your hotshit friends satisfied?"
"You don't look so good," Garrity said. Barkovich smiled cunningly.
"It's all a part of the plan.
You remember when I told you about the plan? Didn't believe me. Olson didn't, Davidson neither, Gribble neither."
Barkovich's voice dropped to a succulent whisper, pregnant with spit.
"Garrity, I danced on their graves."
"Your leg hurt?" Garrity asked softly. "Say, isn't that awful?
Just 35 left to walk down. They're all going to fall apart tonight. You'll see. There won't be a dozen left on the road when the sun comes up. You'll see. You and your diddy-bop friends, Garrity, all dead by morning. Dead by midnight."
Garrity felt suddenly very strong. He knew that Barkovich would go soon now. He wanted to break into a run, bruised kidneys and aching spine and screaming feet and all, run and tell McVries he was going to be able to keep his promise.
"What will you ask for?" Garrity said aloud. "When you win."
Barkovich grinned gleefully, as if he had been waiting for the question. In the uncertain light, his face seemed to crumple and squeeze, as if pushed and pummeled by giant hands.
"Plastic feet," he whispered. "Plastic feet, Garrity. I'm just gonna have these ones cut off. Fuck 'em if they can't take a joke. I'll have new plastic feet put on and put these ones in a laundromat washing machine and watch them go around and around and around."
"I thought maybe you'd wish for friends," Garrity said sadly. A heady sense of triumph, suffocating and enthralling, roared through him.
Friends?
Because you don't have any, Garrity said pityingly. We'll all be glad to see you die. No one's going to miss you, Gary. Maybe I'll walk behind you and spit on your brains after they blow them all over the road. Maybe I'll do that. Maybe we all will. It was crazy, crazy, as if his whole head was flying off. It was like when he had swung the barrel of the air rifle at Jimmy. The blood. Jimmy screamed. His whole head had gone heat hazy with the savage, primitive justice of it.
Don't hate me, Markovitch was whining. Why do you want to hate me? I don't want to die any more than you do. What do you want? Do you want me to be sorry? I'll be sorry. I...
We'll all spit in your brains, Garrity said crazily. Do you want to touch me too? Barkovich looked at him palely, his eyes confused and vacant. I'm sorry, Garrity whispered. He felt degraded and dirty. He hurried away from Barkovich. Damn you, McVries, he thought. Why? Why? All at once the guns roared, and there were two of them falling down dead at once, and one of them had to be Barkovich, had to be. And this time it was his fault. He was the murderer. Then Barkovich was laughing. Barkovich was cackling, higher in matter and even more audible than the madness of the crowd.
Garrity! Garrity! I'll dance on your grave, Garrity! I'll dance!
Shut up! Abraham yelled. Shut up, you little prick!
Barkovich stopped, then began to sob.
Go to hell,
Abraham muttered.
Now you did it, Collie Parker said reproachfully. You made him cry, Abe, you bad boy. He's gonna go home and tell his mommy.
Barkovich continued to sob. It was an empty, ashy sound that made Garrity's skin crawl. There was no hope in it.
Is little Uggy Wuggy gonna tell mommy?
Kintz called back.
Ah, Barkovich, ain't that too bad?
Leave him alone, Garrity screamed out in his mind. Leave him alone. You have no idea how bad he's hurting. But what kind of lousy hypocritical thought was that? He wanted Barkovich to die. Might as well admit it. He wanted Barkovich to crack up and croak off. And Stebbins was probably back there in the dark, laughing at them all. He hurried, caught up with McVries, who was ambling along and staring idly at the crowd. The crowd was staring back at him avidly.
Why don't you help me decide? McVries said.
Sure, what's the topic for discussion?
Who's in the cage? Us or them?
Garrity laughed with genuine pleasure. All of us. And the cage is in the Major's monkey house. McVries didn't join in Garrity's laughter.
Barkovich is going over the high side, isn't he?
Yes, I think so.
I don't want to see it anymore. It's lousy, and it's a cheat. You build it all around something, set yourself on something, and then you don't want it. Isn't it too bad the great truths are all such lies?
I never thought much about it. Do you realize it's almost 10 o'clock?
It's like practicing pole vaulting all your life and then getting to the Olympics and saying, what the hell do I want to jump over that stupid bar for?
Yeah.
You almost could care, right? McVries said, nettled.
It's getting harder to work me up, Garrity admitted. He paused. Something had been troubling him badly for some time now. Baker had joined them. Garrity looked from Baker to McVries and then back again.
Did you see Olson's... Did you see his hair? Before he bought it?
What about his hair? Baker asked.
It was going gray.
Now, that's crazy, McVries said.
but he suddenly sounded very scared. No, it was dust or something.
It was gray, Garrity said.
It seems like we've been on this road forever. It was Olsen's hair getting...